Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers, and you're welcome to call in to ask questions or make comments during the show. For right now, the toll-free number only works in North America. That number is 877-876-5227. Again, 877-876-5227. Otherwise, if you're outside of the U.S. or Canada, please ring 530-876-3222. Again, 530-876-3222. I would like to invite you to visit my website, towardthelight.org, and I also offer services as a clairvoyant medium and a Reiki practitioner, as well as, of course, offering near-death studies and support. This evening, I am very pleased to bring on a new friend of mine, actually, and he has written a tremendous book called The Force is With Us. Please welcome Dr. Thomas Walker. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hey, Julia. I'm doing great.
Oh, that's good. It's really nice to have you with us, and I really enjoyed reading the chapter of your book. Now, one thing that I would like to ask is your book already published, or is it going to be published in a few months?
I self-published the current version of it almost 2 years ago.
Okay.
And it's what I call the uncut version. But
okay.
I signed a contract last year with a company that specializes in mind, body, spirit books and that sort of thing, and they're going to have it out internationally this coming April.
Okay, so people can actually get a hold of a copy of your book now.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon and all the internet sites, and also from my website, which is theforceiswithus.net.
Okay, and again, that is theforceiswithus.net. It's a great site and a great book, well, at least the chapter that I've had the honor of reading, and it's really enjoyable. And what I'd like to do is discuss, first of all, what brought you into this, and it's very interesting because it looks like, according to the first paragraph of this chapter, and let me see, it's Where Do We Go is the title of the chapter.
Yeah.
It looks like you had a very profound experience with your mom. And I
interviewed
somebody else recently who had an experience with his deceased mother that also prompted him to get into researching these kinds of things. So go ahead, if you'd like to share a little bit about these experiences and what brought you into this exploration, as it were.
The experience you're referring to there, Juliet, was a very, very realistic dream I had about my deceased mother. But I'd already been researching these sorts of things for a long, long time prior to that.
Oh, okay.
But it was a very profound event. What brought me to that, to study these topics, is I've been interested in science since I was a little kid, around 10 years old. And in the ninth grade, I placed in a regional science fair with a project talking about Einstein's relativity theories. But I've also been profoundly interested in spiritual stuff. I got into martial arts at 18. I've been in it a long time. Now, there's a very spiritual aspect to that. I've been a practicing chiropractor for 20 years, and there's also an energetic and spiritual component to that. And I just feel like, Juliet, that there's a purpose for our lives and for the existence of our universe. And science says that that's not so. I mean, if you accept the most accepted orthodox version, is that essentially it's all random. And an awful lot of people just can't accept that, and I don't either.
Oh, I don't either.
Naturally.
No.
So, what I set about to do was to put together a complete picture of a new model, but also to incorporate the great amount of research that's actually out there. That came as the biggest shock to me, is that what you'll always hear skeptics who make up a large part of the orthodox science community, what they'll always say is there's no evidence at all to support these spiritual beliefs. And in fact, in the 7 years I spent on this project, there's a very large amount of research to back this stuff up. It's just not accepted, and that's because of scientific politics.
Good point. Very good point.
In my opinion. But that's based on a lot of, you know, looking into it for a long time. The event with my mother is one of the few, what I would call, true paranormal or psychic events that I've had. I feel like I have insight and intuition, and then I'm a teacher. But what happened, my mother died from cancer in early 1994 at the age of 57. And about a year later, which was just, I guess, before I started this project, as a matter of fact, but I hadn't thought of that till this moment, I had a very disturbing dream. It was enlightening, but it was somewhat frightening, too. And what happened was I suddenly, in the dream, was in my mother's bedroom, and I looked out the window, and she was outside. It was dark outside. And she was outside the window looking in at me. And she wasn't unfriendly, but she wasn't real loving and all. I mean, I hate to say that. I'd rather say, oh, this warm glow was coming off of her. And she looked at me. She had very light blue eyes, and her eyes were real piercing. And she lifted her left hand and waved, and then just kind of backed off into the distance. In other words, she was floating, and then faded from view. And I think it was profound, because I think it was her way of telling me that she was okay, and that her soul was still in existence in another realm, and that she was doing fine. It spooked me because I knew that it was not an ordinary dream. Now, there's no way to prove that scientifically. Of course, that's real subjective. But I could just feel, and I woke up instantly. I was very frightened or shocked by it, you know, just spooked, because I knew it was something profound that had happened. And when I wrote the chapter on life after death or near-death experiences, you know, which I'm very interested in, reincarnation, that sort of thing, I try to introduce each chapter with some kind of an antecedent story or something of interest, and I chose that one because it had a profound meaning for me. I truly believe in my heart my mom was just telling me that she was okay and that that she was waiting on us here. She's doing fine.
I really get that sense, too, and I also get the sense that she was herself doing a bit of exploring and going through some self-discovery about her new form, even though, you know, really on the other side, having been there myself, there is no time or space.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is always experienced in the now.
And I truly believe that, yes.
Yes, and there's a lot of profound changes that happen. And, of course, being that I'm a multiple NDE, I've done a lot of research on top of having my own experience.
Oh, I'd say, yeah.
And it really helps to bring a lot of things to light. But I was noting a sentence in one of the... I did read this whole chapter. I
appreciate this. It's one of my favorites.
It was really good. But it's interesting because you had made a statement that in one of your paragraphs here that nobody has come back to... you know, talk about the afterlife in at least 2,000 years, and I would have to say I beg to differ.
Okay.
Because there have been a number of us, and a growing number of us, all the time that have come back from the afterlife to share about it. And
oh, that's an excellent point, Julian. I didn't realize what you mean until right now.
Yes, yes.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. Because, you know, some people... Now, I know that I didn't, but some people have actually come back whilst in the morgue. So, George Redonia had actually been in the morgue and literally dead for 3 days.
So no, I didn't know that. That's shocking. No, I did not know that.
He was a tremendous man from, at that time, what was called the Soviet Union. In other words, he was from Russia.
Yeah.
And he was assassinated by the KGB. And he was dead as people get. And he was in the morgue. And then they took him, and he was on the autopsy table. His uncle was one of the presiding doctors in the operating theater when suddenly he came to.
Wow. Like, is he...
them away. So.
Oh, I'd say, yeah.
He had some very special stories to share about his experiences. So, and as you've pointed out also in this chapter, that, and others have too, near-death experiences have been happening since human beings have existed.
Oh, yeah. All through history, they've been reported.
Exactly. It's only been in more recent times that they have been reported a lot more. And also, we are able to see and experience energy. Now, it's interesting that you talk about this in your work as a chiropractor.
Yeah.
And I'm a Reiki practitioner, and this is all about
great
energy.
Stuff.
Yes. So, you know, I'd really love to learn more. Have you had an out-of-body experience, for example?
No, and I'm slightly jealous of that fact, and I'm slightly relieved by it, too. But now there's a large number of people, I think somewhere as high as 50% that's polled that said they have. It's quite common, but I personally, to my knowledge, have not. I had a question, Judith. Was the gentleman, the Russian gentleman you were talking about, is he a psychologist, or do you know? Because I may know of that case, but I had no earthly idea he was just, you know, out of body for 3 days. That's what I find so amazing.
Yes. You know, at the moment, I can't remember, but
But I totally agree with you. What I was doing there was making a subtle reference to Christ.
Yes.
You know, coming, you know, being resurrected and truly resurrected from the dead. But now, what I didn't know until now is that some of these people that had a near-death experience were out for that long of a time.
Yes.
That really comes as quite a surprise. I want to look into that more. And then, obviously, I definitely stand corrected then.
Well,
that's astounding.
You're doing such wonderful work. Now, mind you, of course, I've only seen the chapter, and it would be lovely to see the whole book, but you've covered a lot of ground in this chapter. You've done a tremendous job.
And I appreciate it.
It's nice the way that you are discussing near-death experiences and how so many people have been through this, and then also how you discuss the paranormal. Did you have paranormal experiences as a child? It sounds to me like you did, or something really drew you in, because this to me is very, very significant, and you've really...
Well, I really appreciate your thoughts. So, not, you know, I'd love to be able to say yes, but... Nothing other than I feel like I have an insight. I have what I think is what's called clairsentience.
Yes.
Where you feel things, and I do that in healthcare all the time, and also with my research. And I know it sounds crazy. In one of I'm a big martial art fan. I'm a fan of Bruce Lee, a very profound spiritual man, and he makes a statement in one of those movies: "Don't think, but feel." And that's what I'm trying to express, and that's called clairsentience. Sentience,
very
if
good.
I'm pronouncing it correctly. And
yes.
I truly believe I have that. I'm insightful, but I've not had. I've had some little bouts of precognition but a lot of people have that, where the phone will ring and you just know who it is.
Yes.
Now, some of that you can logically infer because it might be a relative that calls at a certain time, but often it's someone you didn't expect to call from, and you still knew who it was. You know, I've had those sorts of things.
Well, that's a good example of telepathy right there, and this is also a subject that we like to bring up.
Oh, yeah. Fully been proven, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
They've done it under shielded conditions and, you know, from submarines underwater and, well, from the moon, you know, Edgar Mitchell.
Yes, who started the Institute of Noetic Science.
Great organization, in my opinion.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's a hero of mine.
Now, you were in the military also,
yes,
as I understand, in the Marines.
Actually, I was in the Army, but I was in an elite Army unit.
Oh, okay. And when you were in the military, were you doing research or using your intuition at that time?
I'm sure, Juliet, that it heightened it. Because I was already a martial art instructor when I went into the Army at age 24. Which was in those days, this was in 79, that was, I was the oldest guy in the company going through. And yeah, because I went in infantry and then I tried out for special forces and they sent me to jump school and I made it through that and I graduated from special forces, what's called the Q course up at Fort Bragg. And, you're put through a lot of physical and mental exertion. And I think that heightened my self-discipline. but I think it greatly heightened. Even though it's arts of war, that's a warrior code in an organization like that. You know, they're very, very intelligent men. They're highly disciplined, and they're not the Rambo character that we see in Hollywood. So yeah, I mean, I feel like that was one of the most valuable experiences of my life.
And then, what led you into the healing arts?
I'd always been interested in healthcare. My maternal grandfather, James Riggs, my mother's dad, was a farmer as a young man, and then a skilled tradesman and a building inspector as an adult. And he was a very sharp guy, and he was very interested in natural health care back in the 60s and prior to that, when it wasn't popular like it is now. And back in those days, they called them health nuts, you know, people that took vitamins. And
I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and they were highly criticized. But for whatever reason, my grandfather was very interested and knowledgeable about that. And when I was a young guy, particularly as I got in my early teens, he used to talk with me a lot about it, and it struck a chord with me. And when I look, that's exactly why I eventually became a chiropractic physician. And the reason I did that was because I've always been interested in alternative care, complementary and alternative medicine, as they call it, or CAM. And I just feel, I've always felt that was, for a lot of these problems, is a better way. And it was his early influence on me that led me to that.
Well, I think that is really tremendous. And also, using your intuition when you are working with your patients, and of course, as I do Reiki, I'm always applying my intuition as well and reading the patient. And I'm sure you do that a lot. And it is so very important, because it will generate, I believe, a lot more accuracy and empathy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
With the individual. Now, I know that when we sort of corresponded before, we were really wanting to bring up an important topic, which
you're
on the healing end, and of course I'm a healer too, as Reiki, but also I have been on the wrong side of the needle, as it were, being in hospital, being in coma. Being in the intensive care units and actually being dead. And the whole issue of the how people would determine brain death.
The whole brain dead,
exactly.
Definition of death.
And
very shocking when I looked into that.
What are some of the things you found out? Because I know that I've got some strong feelings about it, too, being that I was on the other side.
Oh, yeah. Let me back up. I'm sorry. I graduated from chiropractic school in 1986, and we had the same basic sciences and medical sciences and so forth that a physician or a dentist has, except we specialize eventually in musculoskeletal conditions. And we were taught, essentially, that, you know, brain death was exactly what it implies, that it was an injury or a condition to the brain where the patient was irreversibly in a coma, there was no activity at all in the brain, and there was no hope, and there was no power that could, or anything that could change that. And the first question arose when I was researching the forces with us, when I began looking at near-death experiences. And the standard reply to those by orthodox science and the skeptics is that since they often occur, you know, when a person is ill, injured, or under anesthesia, that they're a hallucination or a dream or some sort of an imagined event. And that makes a very plausible explanation, you know, very satisfactory, except for the glaring fact that there's been a number of cases where the patient was declared brain dead. They had him hooked up to an electroencephalogram, an EEG, measuring brain waves, and there was no activity.
Exactly.
And yet they eventually came back to full functioning and reported elaborate near-death experiences. So the alternative scientists and the people that study spiritual and paranormal events show that as at least some evidence that these things are genuine. I mean, these people, because if you're dead and you have no brain activity, you can't possibly have a hallucination.
Exactly.
It would be physically impossible by the medical field's own definitions. But yet they did it anyway. So that was the first question that arose, and I was working on that in the mid-90s. And I came across some information about exactly how the concept of brain death began in the medical field. And it's very shocking and it's upsetting, but it's typical, unfortunately. I've also written a book on that. My agent has it right now called Bitter Pill.
Ooh, that, I'd like to
it talks about
that.
Other things, but it brings this up there. What it is, in a nutshell, now these were the opinions of investigative reporters and police that looked into this. When organ transplantation became possible, when technology and medicine became such that we were actually able to transplant organs, it opened up a great new era for people that were seriously ill that needed organs, but it immediately created a shortage of organs. There's only a certain number of people that donate. You can't sell an organ. You know, there's medical ethics involved. So in a very short time, once it became widespread around the world in westernized countries, there became a shortage of organs. And organs, particularly like the liver and the heart, have to be harvested from the donor, preferably before the heart stops beating, and certainly within 3 or 4 minutes afterwards, or they're gone. Now, some of the other things like kidneys and other organs can be harvested, which is the term they use, several minutes and sometimes hours afterwards is still good. But those vital kidneys and hearts that are so needed around the world and, in developed countries, you really need to get those out of a person while their heart is still working or they're on a ventilator, while it's still getting oxygen and blood flow. Traditionally, prior to this, the definition of death was just the cessation of heart activity. In other words, the heart quit beating. When organ transplantation became possible and there became a shortage of organs, they decided on the term, what we call now brain dead. And they established a series of criteria of what would be considered dead now. And it had to do with brain activity. But the problem is, Julia, is there's many levels of consciousness. And it's true that a lot of people that are seriously injured or impaired to the point they don't have brain activity never recover and subsequently die. There's a small percentage that do, approximately 2 to 4 out of 100. So there's 2 to 4% of these people, studies have shown, investigators have found, that fully recover even though they've been declared brain dead. Because they were left on a ventilator long enough or taken care of long enough, because they weren't an organ donor, as we'll find out in a minute, that they were able to recover. Some others, another percentage, recovered but were seriously impaired. But the majority of them didn't. But the point is, it's not 100%, and it's a definition, and it varies from state to state. The last I read, there were approximately 12 different definitions of brain death, depending on what area of the country you're in. Now, that may sound shocking, but I need to remind the listeners that the laboratory values that's used in medicine every day are not absolutely the same everywhere in the country either. And I know that sounds crazy, but they're not. When you give lab values of ordinary blood tests and so forth in medicine, you have to specify which lab standards you're using. Now, they don't vary much, but they vary some. So it's never the exacting science they want us to think. And I don't mean to ramble here.
No,
so what happened was, once brain death became the accepted standard for declaring when a person was dead, according to what the researchers found, was that they started changing the definition to get more candidates for organ transplant.
Okay,
I know that sounds awful. I'm not saying they're murdering these people, and I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that so-called brain death is not the definitive condition that it's always said to be, and it's different in different parts of the country. In some areas, if you go, your heart quits beating, if you've been declared brain dead and your heart stops for over 2 minutes, then if you're a donor, on your donor card they start taking the organs. In other parts of the country, it's as much as 7 minutes or more.
The body is still alive, but the brain is considered dead.
Yeah. But once again, though, studies have shown, or experience has shown, that some of these people recover, even though they have been declared brain dead and they're flatlined on the EEG. But they're going ahead and harvesting these organs from these people for humanitarian purposes, but still. There's been cases in the information that I've read where they quoted specific cases. There was one in Toledo, Ohio, where a lady was shot by a man in the head, but she was still had full function, and because she was brought to the ER because she was a donor, and I'm not saying not to be a donor. The doctors went ahead and removed her organs, and the neurosurgeons examined her a few minutes later and were outraged because they said they could have saved this woman.
Wow.
I was going to say this a moment ago. It got so bad, according to the the articles that at the Cleveland Clinic, which I suppose is in Cleveland, Ohio, I'm sure, which is a very well-respected center, they actually threatened the doctors there with assisted homicide with some of the stuff, how narrow they were making this range. I know that's awful, and my point being is that, not to be a donor, by all means, it's great to go ahead and do that, but a lot of science and medicine has political and business motivations. I mean, it's like any other human activity. And,
yes, indeed.
You know, it's the fact that these people were brain dead didn't mean they were irretrievably gone because they proved they weren't. You know, the ones that had the NDEs and came back and told us about them.
And
so that's kind of shocking. And I didn't know that, but it answered a question I'd had for a long time. Of course, it makes you a little more cynical.
Well, it certainly is a very thought-provoking thing here, you know, that to consider all of this and the fact that, it seems to happen a lot in a lot of very modern establishments, you know, whether it's in America or Europe or, you know, even in China or what have you, is that it seems that people are in such a rush to get something or do something.
Yeah.
And still, there are so many gray areas, as it were, about what actually constitutes death at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing that I've brought up a lot is, this was an induced flat line of the brain of a woman in England who had a tubular pregnancy, and I can never remember the medical term for that, but they actually had to bring her into the operating theater, and part of the procedure was they had to drain her brain completely of blood. So she was totally flatlined. She had a near-death experience, and she had these, you know, she described seeing her daughter on the first day of school and all of this.
Is that right?
Then she was revised, and she described all of this perfectly. And then there are other people, and there's two different types of flatlining, of course, too. There's the heart that flatlines, and then there's the brain that flatlines.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of people like myself who've been in comatose for several weeks, and then they die for a while, and then have what is often being referred to as a spontaneous recovery. In other words, they are not resuscitated by the medical establishment or anything like that.
Yeah, they just naturally return.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Because Spirit says, you've still got some work to do. You've got to let people know that life is eternal. Now, something else that I would like to bring up about the brain is and I think you may have brought this up a little bit, too, in your chapter. I read so many things and some things at the same time. I don't remember what came from whom. So bear with me here. But one thing that I do like to discuss is the fact that, you know, a lot of people are still so set on thinking that the brain is the source of consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
I beg to differ.
I do, too. That's materialistic, reductionistic thinking.
Yes, it is.
Newtonian.
Because people are, and getting back to the NDE and the, you know, people thinking that it's a hallucination. Well, first of all, just like you said, when somebody flatlines, then the brain is not active.
Yeah, it's impossible for it to be under those conditions by the very scientific definition, for it to be a hallucination, a dream, or an imaginary type event.
Exactly.
The brain's incapable of that at that point, according to their own definition.
Exactly. And so then, that to me is, right there, is proof that consciousness comes from outside of the brain. And I think the brain is being like a radio. It is simply a receiver.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think.
Not the source of consciousness. And also, the fact is, unlike hallucinations, near-death experiences or experiences do have after effects that last the rest of their lives.
The psychologists, and the one that comes to mind initially is Charles Tart, that have studied people who have had near-death experiences, say they've never, ever in their entire clinical and scientific careers seen any event change a person like a near-death experience.
That's the truth.
They said they've never seen anything else like it there, and it's almost always positive. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm preaching to the choir when I'm telling you this, because you know all this, but you know, it changes them profoundly. They become more compassionate and loving, and more attached to what's going on. You know, more caring. In other words, just a heightened spirituality. And then it's widely reported that they often have trouble after that wearing a watch. Operating electronic equipment sometimes is a problem.
Oh, I've had a few.
Like it changed their biomagnetism,
yeah,
their energy.
Yeah, I can't wear a watch.
Oh, really?
No, because we literally become rewired.
That's what I think. And according to what I've read and the studies and the people I've spoken with and so forth, that's precisely what I think. So they say psychologically it's essentially the most profound event that can happen throughout life.
Well,
in so many words,
they
say
that.
Yeah.
I would have to say so, because also it really
profound.
Teaches us that we are spiritual beings first and foremost.
Oh, yeah.
Inhabiting a physical body, which is really just a shell.
That's precisely what I think.
But I think the work that you are doing and the work us near-death experiences are doing, because obviously we were all sent back for a reason. Now, some people were sent back, you know, to raise their children and all
yeah.
of that kind of stuff. But it was my NDEs were more what is referred to as transcendent and not so personal.
Oh, okay.
So what, you know, the difference in those is that I was experiencing and seeing and learning things about the universe and about different dimensions and about life itself and how it exists on different dimensions simultaneously, and also the fact that I had to come back to teach, to share
in
a very loving way that life is indeed eternal. This is not just hearsay anymore. It's not just a beautiful, you know, dream or idea.
That's amazing.
This is something that we have obviously been sent back to share because it is real. Otherwise, there shouldn't have been any reason for me to come back. I had terminal cancer, and I actually was flatlined on my 34th birthday.
That's amazing. See, I didn't know this because Juliet and I are friends, but we don't know each other that well. That's absolutely extraordinary.
It was really extraordinary to me, too, and I felt the most profound peace, indeed.
Yeah, I've heard. Of course, yeah, I'm sure you have too. But I've heard that a lot. I mean, that's very common. They say just, well, a lot of them don't want to come back.
And I didn't.
What I've read, I mean, what I can imagine, I can see why.
Well, it's interesting because, again, I don't think that so many people would have been sent back if there weren't something to all of this.
Oh yeah.
You, as a medical professional, I really appreciate the research and the work that you're doing, because we need people on both sides of the fence to help validate and prove all of this.
Yeah, you need to in any activity like this, it's often out of mainstream thinking, which is the kind that interests me all the time. It's a matter of establishing credibility, and that takes some time. And you almost have to force the evidence on the orthodoxy to get them to change. But it's happening. You know, I started researching heavily this sort of thing in 1995. And I'd studied a lot prior to that, but I mean to do the research and to do the books I've written. And it's changed even during that time. You know, in other words, things like intelligent design that's being seriously considered among biologists and specialists, that the world indeed was created by an undefined and greater intelligence. That's gaining a lot of clout. Oxford University is, if they haven't already, are going to open a consciousness study department. I guess, you know, within maybe the Department of Psychology. I'm not sure about that, but I know they're adding a consciousness study. I think there's a great. I think we're on the cusp of a great spiritual reawakening, and a lot of people seem to be able to feel that, and I think I do. And I don't mean that in any egotistical sense. I mean, I just feel it. I mean, what I'm curious about is what's going to happen in 2012.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners know what I'm talking about, the Mayan calendar, as incredible as it may sound, the ancient Mayan calendar, you know, from the the essentially prehistoric tribes that were in southern Mexico and Central America had a calendar that's more accurate than our modern Gregorian calendar.
Oh, way more accurate.
Yeah, that's an established fact. I mean, we know that. I can quote the specifics, but...
Mm.
And they divided eras into great cycles, and the last one began on August the 13th, 3114 B.C., and it will end on the winter solstice, December 21st, 2012. And they're not saying that that's, by any means, that that's the end of the world, although some people say that. But it's a time of great change, and I think that's why we're experiencing some of the things we are in the environment and the political situation around the world. Is that we're about to undergo a profound change, and I feel it's going to be a great spiritual reawakening, and I think that's why things like the Da Vinci Code and the Purpose Driven Life and these things, the great movie What the Bleep Do We Know?
Yeah.
Why these things are so popular now? Is that people there's a thirst for this, the answers to these questions that science doesn't provide for us? They tell us the hows or try to, but not the whys.
And I think at some point that there could end up being a marriage between science and spirituality.
Yeah.
Because
I essentially think it's happening now, Julia.
Yes, yes. Actually, I've had PMH Atwater on my show, and she's going to be on again on the 21st of August. And in her recent book called Beyond the Indigo Children, The New Children, and the Coming of the Fifth World, she is talking about 2012, on 21st December, just as you were mentioning.
Yeah.
And actually, we are, as she put it, we are moving into the ascension process of the fifth world, or the blue race. And she explains all of this in her book because she's really wanting people to become more aware and accurately aware of what's going on with these new children that have been born since 1982.
I've heard of that, Julie, but only just in the vaguest sense. What are they, profound beings in some way? Or?
Well, they've got a lot more intelligence, a lot more awareness, and I think partly what got her so interested in this too is because she was noting the similarity between children born since that time, 1982, and near-death experiences. I am also a childhood NDE as well as an adult NDE. And again, as a result of the NDE, we're completely rewired. Our consciousness changes. Our level of intelligence changes.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, being really unintelligent, I've had heightened intelligence as a result of the NDE.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
So this
yeah.
got her into really researching and interviewing a lot of children. These children have got tremendously high IQs, off the charts.
Is that right? I need to look into that because I'm greatly interested in that sort of thing. And as I say, I've heard of that. I've heard the term indigo children, but I didn't know until now. That's amazing. I want to look into that.
Well, actually, she points out that indigo is not an accurate term, nor is crystal, nor any, you know, star seed, star children, all of that.
Yeah.
And that's why she explains in the book what the truth about these kids and this age are. So, yes, it's really good to look into, and for our listeners to know, also these shows are archived, so you can listen to them anytime. It is just so tremendous to talk to all of these people and to see this commonality in all of this. But I feel that the world as we've known it, or perhaps the paradigm, I should say, is going to die. But
not
the human species and not the planet, not by any means. But we're definitely going through a quickening.
I started to use that term a moment ago because that's a common term, and that's why time seems to be transpiring faster all the time.
That's
what other people have said to me, and I that's what I think.
Yes.
Yeah. We're ascension, I think, was the term you used at that. It sounds good to me.
Yes, and
I really believe that we're at that point.
She was talking, she was using the term that the calendar is rolling over into the ascension. She basically points out that every age has got a descension period and a devolutionary period and an ascension period or evolutionary period. We've been more in the devolutionary period and descension, and we are getting ready to move into the ascension process. So that is going to change the way we think, the way we live, the way we do things. There's not going to be such an emphasis on materialism because there won't be so much of this fear of lack. And the big, big point of the work that I'm doing and the work that so many people are doing is to help people overcome fear. Because fear isn't real either. And in fact, I point out in the last paragraph of the account of my near-death experience that I had in the 70s, in the mid-70s, was that fear is an acquired state. It is not a natural one.
Sounds good to me, yeah. I definitely think that fear, things like emotions like fear and guilt inhibit spiritual development.
They really, really do.
And it's sad because a lot of people are that purport to be helping people are instilling a lot of guilt in them in some instances. So.
And I think also when people can remember that we are divine in essence and that we are eternal, we are not our bodies, and that's why all of this work is being done to really prove that so that people will no longer have this fear of lack or fear of death.
I know one of the things that really stood out to me when I did my research was that when you ask the individual people that have had the near-death experiences, boy, there's no doubt in their mind.
No.
Whatsoever. I mean, they are positive that they have seen the other side and it was good, wonderful thing, and they certainly had no more fear of it.
Well,
they also had no doubts that it wasn't genuine. There was no doubt in their mind whatsoever. They knew in their innermost being that what they had experienced was genuine.
Well, as you probably found out in your research, is that there was such a consistency with the testimonies of these different individuals.
Oh, yeah, that too, yeah.
Regardless of the culture, of their age, anything like that, there is a consistency in what people share. And, you know, the biggest one, I think, is this very loving light that envelops us, loves us unconditionally, and accepts us too. And there is no damnation. Now, I will point out, which, you know, is not always pleasant or people don't like to hear about it, but yes, there are also unpleasant, there have been unpleasant hell-like NDEs.
I don't know much about that, but I'm aware that there has been some of that. Yeah.
Yes. But what's interesting, and I will point out, too, that during my big NDE as an adult 30 years ago, I did see hell, but I was just observing it from the outside, or a hellish space.
I'd say that was profound and then some.
Oh, yes.
What do you think, as far, and that's a burning question with me, and I was aware that there was some of that had occurred. Based on your insights and experiences, do you feel that that's an example of a biblical-type fire and brimstone existence?
Oh, no.
I'd very much like to know your thoughts on that.
In fact, when I was observing that and the souls that were going through that, I kept being reassured in no uncertain terms that this is just a temporary state.
For their spiritual development or...
Correct. And also no one, and I repeat, no one can ever be separated from the light source. Because the light source is everywhere and in everything.
Yeah.
There's only the perception of separateness. That's what hell is. Hell
that's
is
amazing.
Really,
it seems like I've heard that before, but that's really profound, I think. I mean, seriously, that would be because we're all one, in my opinion. I think if there's any really profound truth, and I've been studying philosophy a lot lately to really get to the nitty-gritty, so to speak, of science and the way we think and conceptualize reality, is that we're all one. Everything is a fundamental energy, just exactly as the ancients, like the Chinese and so forth, said. And that's why, of course, I call it the Force, because everybody knows what's meant by that from the great Star Wars movies.
And I like that, too. That is a common term, the Force is with us.
Because, you know, in the Chinese martial arts that I've been involved with for so many years, it's called Qi. And which is fine, but not everybody knows what that means. And, you know, in Hinduism, it's called prana, and there's like over 100 terms around the world.
Well, it does that just a little because, let's see, it's
okay.
Sometimes spelled C-H-I, and it's also spelled Q-I.
Yeah.
Okay. And then in Reiki, which has got a Japanese basis, Ki,
it's
the same thing, K-I. It is the universal life force.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. Yeah. As I understand it, when I got into martial arts in the early 70s, Chi was spelled in those days C-H-I, and that's the way I'm used to seeing it. But the Q-I is still pronounced Chi, but it's an alternative spelling, and it seems to be a little more popular right now. But in my writings, I always used C-H-I. And then, yeah, the Japanese, precisely, that's exactly what they call it, is Ki, K-I, which is one of the more common terms. I should have said that a moment ago. Yeah, the life force, and yeah.
Well, they both are. One is just Chinese and the other
yeah,
Japanese.
It's just, yeah, it's just
the same meaning, thing.
Precisely the same thing.
What is
yeah,
the
I really
martial
think...
art that you do?
I'm sorry?
What is the martial art technique that you...
It's called Kajikembo, and it's a Hawaiian style. It's actually the first original American martial art because it started in 1947 in Hawaii. Now, Hawaii wasn't actually a state at that time, but it was soon to become one. And... Five gentlemen in Honolulu, or outside of Honolulu, actually in the rough part of town, pool their knowledge of different arts. That's where the name comes from. Ka is for karate, Ju is for jiu-jitsu, judo, Ken is for kenpo, which is Chinese karate, and Bo is boxing, is what the Chinese refer to as kung fu. In other words, the Chinese, when they say the word kung fu, that just means to acquire skill. It doesn't necessarily imply martial arts, so they refer to martial arts as boxing. But they don't mean it in the Western sense. And it just so happened, I grew up in a small town in Middle Tennessee, and my instructor studied in the Navy in Hawaii for several years, and then returned back to a small town where I lived. About the time I was getting out of high school, I had the opportunity to study at that time, and I just never have stopped. I've studied some other styles, but the Kajikembo is the primary one. And I still teach classes in it today. So it's great stuff. And then the Chinese arts have put a strong emphasis on internal development and qi and energy, as do some of the other arts. Aikido is a Japanese one that does a great deal, and also I've studied qigong and tai chi and still practice some qigong, and that's very much concerned with that. So I feel very strongly that there's something to that.
Well, again, I want to validate that from the perspective of an NDEer who's actually seen this energy on the other side.
Oh, I'd love to hear what you say about that.
It is really quite stunning, and there's actually, well, I think you had even mentioned this in the chapter as well, but there is music, there is sound associated with this. Well, PMH Atwater, bless her, she talks about this a lot in her writings, and I was actually able to hear the music of the spheres.
I've heard that term before.
Yes. And see this energy, and then again, as a Reiki practitioner, feeling this energy and then remembering being on the other side, and then the work that you are doing, integrating the martial arts, and then also as a chiropractor, I'm sure that you feel this energy too.
Yeah, definitely. You definitely can feel it.
If you start listening to your intuition, you can actually start to get messages through that energy, if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, I certainly believe, and among a lot of other people, that the energy is conscious, that energy contains information by its very nature, and that this energy has consciousness, and that
absolutely.
You can connect with it and just bond with it and receive information, for lack of a better way of terming that.
And
yeah, absolutely.
Again,
I think it all is. I think everything has consciousness.
Everything has got consciousness, and I've even come to understand that every cell within the body has got the consciousness and awareness of the universe.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I think that's exactly right.
So there is a lot to understand, and again, remembering that we are all divine in essence.
That's what I think.
The core of our being is divine, and it's only the ego that's experiencing amnesia that has forgotten who we really are. But I would like to get the titles of your books and also let our listeners know about your website once again, Tom.
Okay. Well, the book that's currently out is The Force is With Us, and the subtitle is The Conspiracy Against the Supernatural, Spiritual, and Paranormal. I self-published it at my own company called Roaring Fork Limited. It's available from Amazon and all the web, the internet sites. It also can be ordered at the local bookstore. And it'll be in the bookstores beginning next April, nationwide and overseas. The current version, also is from my website, is theforceiswithus.net. The current version is almost 500 pages long, but they say it's wonderful, but it's overwhelming. So it's being edited right now, so it'll be smaller than that. They're going to cut some of the information out of it. But I understand, because it is, I tried to write the definitive text, Julie, and I believe I did, but it's a bit much. I mean, it reads real well. It reads like a suspense novel, but there is a lot of information, but this is what I call the writer's uncut version. So.
Well, it'd be really nice to see the uncut version.
I'll have to get you a copy of it here.
Especially because I'm a writer myself, and I really enjoy and appreciate all of this information. And again, your website is theforceiswithus.net. And there is a place where people can order the book on that site.
Yeah, I have a PayPal site and everything there. So.
Okay, great. Now, have you got another book in the works? It sounds like you
do.
Yeah.
My two primary interests are spiritual phenomena and philosophy, and then also healthcare. And I've written a book called Bitter Pill, and the subtitle is Why the Practice of Medicine is a Dying Art. And it's, as the title implies, it's a little bit critical of the medical field. It's also critical of our brothers and sisters out here, in society, the people that won't take responsibility for their health.
Exactly.
And that's a great, great part of the problem. Medicine is a business. It's, in fact, believe it or not, it's the biggest business in the United States, $1.6 trillion, 14% of the gross national product.
Wow.
It's enormous. But our health problems are escalating. And it's due to many reasons. That's what the book talks about. A lot of it is it's because it's controlled by the pharmaceutical and oil companies.
Absolutely.
Oil derivatives are used, coal tar, to construct vitamins and organic compounds and drugs out of. And unfortunately, medicine is controlled by that. And some would say the FDA is subject to persuasion. In fact, they've proven that with Vioxx and things like that, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, absolutely.
But then a lot of it is people. Health is our own responsibility.
Thank you for saying that. Now, we've got just 1 minute left for this transmission of Toward the Light, and it has just been so wonderful having you with us.
Thank you.
When is
the
Bitter
great.
Pill due to be released?
The Bitter Pill, we don't have a release date on it yet.
Okay.
My literary agent has it. It will probably be in a publisher's hands by the end of the year, and it could be next fall, but I'm not sure. There's usually a year or so's lead time on that.
Okay. Well, we'll
it's a great book. I'm excited. It's kind of a pet project.
That's wonderful. Well, I look forward to reading it, too, and we'll just have to keep everybody updated on that. Tom, it's been so wonderful having you with us. And
it's been a pleasure.
You back again. And I want to thank everybody for joining us for this transmission of Toward the Light. And please remember that only love prevails. Blessings to all. We'll talk to you next week.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.